Up next with Natalia, part two.
Names are important.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's really cool that you had a chance to sort of actualize formally on paper.
Right.
What you sort of felt inside.
So yeah.
Kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Really fancy.
It made my life a lot less complicated too, because I had all these other names that people were like, wait, your name's Olga? Like, they meet me and then they'd have to pay me and be like, I'd be like, oh yeah, so make it out to Olga Mendes. Like, you know.
They'd be like, have you been lying?
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah.
It makes me think about some of those, I mean, the length of your name, right, sort of speaks to the limitations of technology, where you're allowed to have like 24 characters, but you're like, what if my name is 30 characters?
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever. So it's always,
it's got to be a tweet, right?
Yeah, like. Yeah, it's got to be a tweet. And it's like, okay, what are we going to do here?
I don't know. In Mexico, in a Catholic community, you want, I had like a saint name too. You know, I just didn't even include those in papers because I was like, no, this is like too much. They're going to like, and then I have issues sometimes with like renting cars or like, it was kind of difficult to prove my identity because like, you know, like if my credit card, my debit card or credit card say Olga N. Roca Fuerte or whatever, but then when I'm applying, it says Olga Natalia. They're like, well, you know, my mom did mess up my social security 1 year too. When we did get our green cards, she put Olga N. Dot. So for the longest time, my name wasn't even Natalia. Like it was just like I was lying. So yeah.
That sounds way too complicated.
Yeah, it was just way too complicated to hold on to that. Yeah. Like, I was like, I'll just tell people my name was Olga. Like, I don't need it on paper.
Yeah, I think the extent for me when I was younger was mispronunciations. Hmm. Yeah, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and Rocafuerte is already like a mouthful. So
yeah, but it's very strong. I mean, you know.
Yeah, literally. It's
literally
in the name.
Yeah.
It's in the name, yeah. I do run into people who call me, they're like, Olga. And I'll be like, oh, yeah.
I remember her.
I remember her. Yeah.
Oh, my twin. She's somewhere else.
She's doing great.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I want to talk about some of your work.
Okay.
So that's another reason why I want to chat with you, because language is a part of your work. So tell us a little bit about
Let's geek out. So I do video work, but my background was also in printmaking, which I feel like printmaking and language is just like revolutionary. But for my graduate thesis project and the project I've been working on for the past 3 years, I was collecting dreams because when I got my citizenship, I had this whole like crisis of identity of like, when did I start to dream in English? And like, I'm super American. I was changing my name at the time, right, too. So I kind of felt like at that time, I felt like I was betraying my past or something. So I got really into Jungian psychoanalysis. I treated myself to a psychoanalyst. And I really liked some of the methodology in that form of therapy. So because it makes you think about the age that you're in during the dream, the location, and for me it was the country as well, because I dreamt a lot about Mexico, even though I hadn't been in a couple of years. So for my thesis project, I created videos and large prints of text and visual graphics and language regarding to dreams I collected through a dream hotline where people could call in for 6 months and tell me their dreams. And then when they answered them, it was based on a Jungian survey, which kind of went over what I just, you know, mentioned, like location, age, language of dream, and like, you know, feeling, which is the basic of dream therapy.
The following is a selection from Natalia's project, Dream Machine Archive.
¿Qué edad tuvo en el sueño? ¿Qué edad tuvo en el sueño? ¿En qué lengua fue el sueño? ¿En qué país estabas?
El número que has marcado no está disponible.
Bueno. Thank you for calling the Dream Hotline. Please answer the following Jungian questions. In what language was the dream? In what country? How old were you in the dream? What did you feel?
Gracias por llamar la línea de sueños. Favor de responder estas preguntas. ¿Qué edad tuvo en el sueño? ¿En qué lengua fue el sueño? ¿En qué país estabas?
I created films and video installations, and I'm making an album out of it. I worked with some musicians to use some of the dreams, but I used a lot of my own dreams too, because for me, even just like, I don't easily remember my dreams. So it was kind of a practice of like, we're not going to party too hard, or, you know, you have to be like in mm-hmm. a good standing with yourself to actually wake up, and like, it's a discipline. So it felt good to have that. So I would listen to these dreams through audio because it was, you know, through a hotline. And then I amplified them through like a radio because I thought that was like a good way to like, kind of have these happenings of dreams. And in the border area where I grew up, there was like illegal American radio stations. There's a history of like amplifying just like whatever you want. But then I started to really want to archive them in some sort of way. And that's why I did the record. But then I started to transcribe the dreams. And some of the people who called were from the border. So half of the dream is in English and in Spanish. There was these wonderful, like, structures of, you know, how the narrative was told. And you can find them through, like, putting it through text. So that's kind of when I started to print the text and work with that. And I made them into, like, billboard-sized dreams and stuff.
When I was listening to some of it, it was primarily women. Is that accurate? I don't recall hearing any men.
I did have some men call, but I mostly... Yeah, I decided to work with the dreams from women specifically. Okay. Just because that was like who mostly was calling me. I'm for the girls, you know, so I got to respect it. I feel like when I was looking at dreams, I saw a lot of like historically like dreams of kings and like, you know, people in power. So in this idea of like it's powerful to archive someone else's whatever, I was like, well, the dreams of girls and women who are... And mostly also interacted with immigrants, mostly Mexican immigrants, because it was the border and Southwest Detroit where I was posting flyers. But then I also had an immigrant from like Korea call in. And so I had to do some like research. And so in rendering the dreams, I used like, I love the idea of like binge watching dreams, or like whenever TV back in the day when there was commercials and just the endless stream of image, kind of like the Jung talked about like the collective unconscious as a stream of symbols or whatever. So I kind of wanted to imitate that with like video and these people's dreams, like you log into a channel of dreams or whatever. To create that, I didn't like create actual like animations or anything. I actually tried to use what I would say is like our collective language, which a lot is like ads and television stuff. So like there was a dream about, one of my favorite dreams is my stepmom called in and she told me a dream about how she dreams that the president of Mexico gets COVID and dies, and this is during the pandemic. So like I, to illustrate that, you know, it's a bunch of weird imagery, it's him, but overlaid with other text, but I cut old footage of when past Mexican presidents have died, you know, and so it's like the funeral and the military's there and like just cutting to different reporters and you can't hear what's happening, but it gives you the exact same motion you get on the day that a president dies. You're just flipping through channels and everyone's talking about it. So like I wanted to build narratives through that, like a collective visual language. And I felt like commercials are really good at doing that because – one, usually it's surreal, but it's also boiled down to elements and symbols. Yeah. So, then I started to print them and, like, work with the actual words of the dreams. And, like, I mean, Jung wasn't into, like, Freud was really into, like, this idea of, like, you dream about your mom, it means this, right? Yeah, yeah. But Jung was, like, everyone has their own, even though he had the collective unconscious, in the therapy, your psychoanalyst makes basically a book of your own symbols to yourself, right? Because it's relative to what you think.
Dreamer, right?
Right. There's certain archetypes he's interested, like the mother or whatever, yeah. but it's never representative of like your mother. It's like, what does it, that word mean to you? And, you know, like whenever I'm nervous, I dream about Adam, who's my boyfriend, who like I would describe him as the most grounded, calm person. And so, you know, in therapy, I've this is my own, you know, idea of like whenever I'm really nervous, I have these dreams where I'm like in malls or stuff and I'm just looking for Adam, right? I'm looking for the symbol of peace. And like, so it's more like that, analyzing dreams in that sense. And so in order to do it with strangers, right, it was like falling back onto like, okay, this person's dreaming about a passport, so I can assume that immigration is important to them. And, you know, like certain things like that, and understanding like, well, from my own experience, I know how scary it is to lose your passport and dream about trying to find it, you know? So, yeah. And that's also just who happened to call. It's, I made the ads in Spanish. So I was trying to recruit women. I mean, I also made ads in English, but, because I was working in Southwest Detroit and the people who called were people from home, like in South Texas, I was like, why not make these ads in Spanish too, to just let people know that they could also tell me their language in the dream they want to.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, tell me the dream in the language they want to. But yeah, a lot of interesting stuff too. Like, I feel like, yeah, I got a lot of feedback on the questions too. Like, people were thrilled to be asked to think about what language your dream is in, especially if you speak multiple languages.
Yeah.
And then like your age in the dream, right? And the location. And no one ever, I feel like 99% of the calls we called, no one ever like dreams about the house they're currently in. It's always like a past house or like a house, like grandma's house, a house that has a certain symbol to them. So, yeah, that was really like, it dealt a lot with language and like using my own dream diaries and stuff. Yeah, it's so interesting to like read a dream also like months after you had it and you're like, what? Like, but yeah.
That was super cool to hear about. Like, just seeing some of that work, I instantly, like, this idea of the TV.
Thank you for
language.
Coming to my show, by
yeah,
the way. Yeah,
yeah, of course. I've actually seen it. Where else did I see it? Because I know I saw it when it opened a little while ago, but I've known about this project for a while.
In your dreams, maybe.
Maybe in my dreams.
Because I talk about it.
Oh, maybe that's true, too. But, like, I was able to see immediately what you were talking about. So, like, this layered communication thing that was going on. I think that's why I'm partially drawn to it, because dreams are super interesting. And
right.
I like dreams as well, but this, like, how do you communicate someone else's dream? And, like, this TV language, right, is, I think that was super effective.
Thanks. I'm a media maximalist, right? There was, like, radio installations.
Yeah.
There was TV. There was, the radio was sound. I had, like, live camera feeds. I had, like, a 360 video.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and like print historically, I feel like, well, I'll get into that later, but
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, but I guess my sort of reaction to that was that it was really effective. And so I also really like the use of the radio, like the amplification, the effect, because I almost felt like I could be dreaming too, right? Like, I was dreaming they were calling in. You know, it's not that, oh, I was in a trance, I didn't know where I was. I meant, like, I could realistically close my eyes and imagine. Like, there's a filter, I think, that sometimes happens over dreams when you're remembering them.
Oh,
versus,
yeah.
Well, at least in my dreams, like, when I'm in them, I'm in them. And I can remember them really, very well. But when I'm re-remembering, there's like, a filter. And somehow this sort of radio, like, I was like, oh, that's what it sounds like, because I'm re-remembering, but I never connected that it sounds similar to that, right? Like, there's this filter over somehow.
Right.
So I was like, wow, that was really good. Like, it was really well done.
I'm glad you liked it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Radio is, like, an amazing sort of media, too, because, well, in language, Adam's dad, he does like this, there's a specific sort of radio, hobby radioists who do like long wave form and stuff, and so they speak to each other through like beeps or whatever, and that's like a language only they understand. But like, yeah, it's also super funny because Adam's dad is like an older man in the mountains in Wisconsin with a big radio tower, like beeping to other dudes in like other part of the country.
It's actually kind of interesting.
It's so cool.
Like, yeah, like this is actually cool. I don't remember what it was called, but like there was a period of time where I was like, let me just see what's out there in the world of radio. I was learning about like audio and stuff like that. And there's like, without needing to get your own equipment, you can, there's certain like websites you can go to, and it, you can broadcast like shows from all over the world, just like different right. radio shows from everywhere. And so you can, if you want to sort of start simple, you can start by just having like a device that can connect you to the internet, that can connect you to these certain like URLs that can help you access different people. And then yeah. you might, you know, get a little bit more advanced where you're like, let me communicate with people. And then even more advanced where you're like, let me get my own radio tower.
Right.
That kind of a thing. It's yeah. kind of cool when you look into it, especially when you, well, okay, never mind. I don't know. That's a different conversation because
well,
there's
yeah,
more to it.
Physics
than that
too. Yeah. And it's like, yeah. it's really amazing to like, and yeah, I feel like his, to me, I had just read this book called Sounds of Belonging. And it talked about how in the border areas in the U.S., there was all these illegal American radio stations who would, like, let's say, like, the FCC regulates that AM frequencies are only supposed to go 15,000 watts or whatever. They would, like, just blast it at 30 all day, you know? And at night, you're supposed to actually lower radio frequencies because there's a higher distance that it can travel because there's less radio traffic. Yeah, I've asked people here in the Midwest, and they would tell me about being able to hear, like, frequencies from Mexico, like, back in the day, right? Before there was the whole migration from AM to FM mm-hmm. frequencies. And I just thought that was so, like, cool. And there's something, yeah, also just when you put on the radio headsets and then you realize that, like, this sound and this frequency is in the air and it's, you know, untangible, but through this device we're able to access, you know, these yeah. dreams. It's like, yeah, it was just really, I feel like media can be really poetic in terms of like communication and sharing our deeper true self through it. It's just finding the right way to, in the right time, right, to do it.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to know and just chat with you more about sort of this experience. I'm not from the border or anything like that, and so in learning more about these like border communities across different states, it's clear to me that there's a lot that I don't understand, and there's like a complexity to the folks who live there and their connection to language and identity and stuff like that, right? So
yeah, so yeah. And also, so within that radio too conversation, I have a joke that my parents won't leave the frontera, like the border, because like they lose all the Mexican frequencies as soon as you get to San Antonio, and that's like literally, I feel like that's wow. kind of why they're there, like
yeah.
because like the yeah, another thing was like radio transcends the border. I mean, you can listen to Canadian radio stations here, right? Because mm-hmm. Canada and Detroit, or, you know, Windsor and Detroit. But I mean, it's just so, you know, I feel like it's just so different than what you would imagine it to be. Like, it's just kind of like hanging out at the border of two states, right? But they're not nations. It's just like things kind of overlap. But yeah, to me, it's been a really, I feel like it's been a great experience to, like, have a better understanding. Again, I thought I was this worldly person from Texas, right? But to, like, understand that there, it's just so complicated. And, like, yeah, like, in Brownsville, right now, actually, there's a celebration called Charo's Days. It's, like, the last 2 weeks. And it's a celebration of, you know, sister cities, border cities. Back in the day, people used to cross the bridge, and there would be parties on both sides of the bridge. But then as immigration got tighter, they stopped doing that because they realized, like, people were, like, saving it up. Like, you yeah. know, like, I'm going to cross, like, that day, that week you can. But, I mean, it's just so, it's such a fluid culture. I mean, there's certain things where you're like, oh, I guess I'm in Mexico versus, like, oh, I guess I'm in the U.S. there. But it's just, like, it's just land. There's, like, really no way to differentiate. It's just, like, the border crossing lets you know. But if you're objectively looking around and the people and what's happening, it's the same place. Just, like, you know, different. It, yeah, you're just hitting the end of one nation and the beginning of another. But Yeah, I mean, I used to hate that area too. I mean, especially when I was more tied in with my Mexican identity, I felt like I was just so confused because it felt like, yeah, one day you just wake up and you're American or whatever. You just like, you speak a certain way or whatever. Mm-hmm. And everything was so meshed together. It was hard for me to understand. But now I look back and I'm like, oh, that's cool, because it's like, yeah, I mean, to me, it cemented this idea of like, it's just so much more complicated because it's land. And I understand like structures and whatnot, but yeah, once you're there, it's just a whole different ball game. I mean, I feel like in South Texas, time even moves slower. It's just its Whoa. Own territory, mm-hmm. you know. And in all sense of the word territory too, it's in flux constantly, right? Like, because things used to be different, like even, I mean, even in the 90s or whatever. But like, before, like my mom's family are from that, like they're like fifth, even though her mom is Lebanese, her dad's side has been in that area for generations and generations. And like, they were there when it, like when Brownsville was still part of Mexico. They were there when the last war of, or like the last battle of the Civil War happened in Brownsville. Weeks after it had been resolved, no one had gotten the message that far south. So it was, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, and like there's this really interesting, like my great grandma, she had like 10 kids, you know, ranch style life. And they were in Brownsville, and she had a daughter who had been ill, and she died in Brownsville. But they had to get her daughter back to Mexico. And I mean, I'm sure there must have been like some sort of way to officially do it. But the story that they told me was that my abuela Mela just brought her daughter in the car. And when Border Patrol asked her for her daughter's ID, she gave it and said, can you let her sleep? Like, she's really tired or whatever. And then she brought her body back to Mexico. But like, that also just to mention too, like people cross the border back mm-hmm. and forth all day. Like, I was there, you know, when last time I was there, I was listening to my aunt say how she was like, I'm going to Matamoros, you know, and then I got to come back by tonight because I got to go pick up your cousins. But then, you know, my house is in Matamoros. You know, like, yeah. It's just so fluid, and it's just crossing a border. It's much less dramatic. I mean, there's definitely migrants, and there's definitely, like, crisis in the border of migrants in the Mexican side of people coming from Nicaragua, mm-hmm. from Venezuela, from Haiti. But most of the border activity that's happening is people who live in that area. I swear. I mean, there's definitely people traveling and coming in. But my own experience of it, and I've lived on both sides, like both towns. I lived in Matamoros and I lived in Brownsville. And my dad at one point had a job in Brownsville, but we lived in Matamoros. And like slowly we started to migrate. But it wasn't like, you know, my story wasn't like as dramatic, because it was like we were in the same land. It was just we crossed a bridge. Mm-hmm. But what an incredible bridge to cross, right? It just totally changed my life. And I had to learn a new language. And, like, you know, it was very dramatic, especially as a kid. But looking back at it, it doesn't feel like that. But, yeah, it's very surreal to, like. And then when I would go visit my friends, there's a certain strip that's closer to the border. There's a border wall. So closer to the border wall, about like, there's like a 2-3 mile radius where there's border patrol stations. Even though you're technically in the U.S., you still like show papers and stuff. So like, you know, and then like you can't get out of the valley because there's a checkpoint before Corpus Christi called the Sarita checkpoint. So when there was like a period in time when my visa was expired, I couldn't go anywhere. I could only be home, because if I went south, I was in Mexico and then I couldn't come back. But if I went north, you know, I technically couldn't go more inland without a visa. Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of weird tangent space, but I think it's really wonderful. I recommend it. No one remembers there's the Gulf that hit a Gulf side that hits Texas. So it's kind of like Texas, Florida, where I'm from, but it's like mostly Mexican people instead of like, you know, populations of Cuban and, you know, mm-hmm. I've never really been to Florida, so I don't really know everyone who's out there, but all my friends who are Cuban are from Miami and they tell me it's great. So.
No, this is super cool to hear about, because like as an outsider, there's definitely, let's say, we're vulnerable to certain narratives about the border and about border communities. And I can't remember exactly the name of the series. I think it might have actually just been called Borders, right? And they were sort of profiling different, like, borders between places. And, you know, they're, I don't know, they sort of depict it in a more extreme way. And it's not to say that complex, difficult stories aren't happening.
Right.
But you would assume that 99%, if not 100%, of turmoil experienced in that area is happening to sort of everybody, right? And so,
right. And, you know, yeah. Where I'm from is different from, like, El Paso. That's more
right.
Southwest. Like, that's more of a desert area. But at least, like, I know, like, in the valley, it feels like people don't like that narrative. People want the community to grow and stuff, too. And it's like, yeah, I think it's just, it's a really, you know, I feel like the valley, South Texas, I went to San Diego last year, and it was so much more like San Diego than like El Paso or what you would imagine. Like, it's like the border wall with palm trees rather than like this desert scape that you think of.
Yeah.
So it's just so, it's relative to the area and like to the history of the land too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like a reason I kind of came to the Midwest too was the area in South Texas I'm from is known for being a like snowbird or like winter Texan hub for Midwesterners from like Iowa and like even Michigan and stuff. And it's yeah, it's a I think it's a great, and the birds also come down there. So that's also, it's funny to see like people come down there and the birds come down there for winter and like the butterflies and stuff.
Yeah.
There's a great bird watching scene. And that's kind of how I want to live my life, where I'm like, oh, I want to be in that rhythm. Yeah. I want to be like a bird. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. And then like things like the border wall, it actually affects those birds and like those, you know, and I don't feel like, because I haven't been in the valley for so long, I can't speak to what it's like, but I don't feel like, I feel like it's just so complicated that like it's really, yeah, multiple people should write theses about border, you know, how to like be someone who lives there and how to be represented in media in the larger conversation.
Yeah.
'Cause it's yeah, people have lived there for a long, long time too. It's not just, it is a big immigrant hub, but it's also like a land that historically has existed. So
yeah.
There's history and people there.
Would you say that it's enough to know the language to fit in some of these communities? Or I wanna assume that it's more, like it requires more than understanding what's being said and also being able to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think because there's like a history to the area and there's certain cultures. There's a Juan Gabriel song that's actually about, I think it's about McAllen, but it's about South Texas. And he talks about how he loves the frontera because like no one minds anybody's business. Everyone keeps each other's noses out of each other's business. Or like there's certain attitudes and cultural things. I feel like there's also different attitudes that like maybe Chicano and Mexican cultures hold towards the U.S. because we've been neighbors for so long and so much of us, our stuff is blended, that sometimes there are things that we think about specifically being Mexican, like tacos or whatever, are one of the big staples of the U.S. too, and we're much more blended into the country than we realize. So yeah, that's what I would think.
Yeah.
That there's like set cultures and histories and ways of doings in different borderlands. But then there's like, I feel like there's other parts that we do understand each other with like Latino culture, like family oriented, family, you know, being an epitome of like Latino culture too.
There was this one book where I was first really starting to read about like borders. Anzaldúa.
Gloria Anzaldúa.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's from the valley.
Yeah. It's one of the first times I really sort of thought about language in this sort of way. And like La Fonadera, she wrote that. And she made this comparison about like the wild tongue, right? And how like by resisting linguistic borders, she's able to embrace her full humanness, right? And I thought that was really interesting. Sort of a, like an interesting sort of self acceptance mechanism.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think it's radical. I mean, so I can only speak to relation to my experience, but I think it is radical acceptance because I am. So from my experience in Mexico, I feel like it is a much more stark contrast of class, or it's a very class-driven society as well. I mean, the U.S. too, arguably, but like, you know, and I talk about this term fresa, which means strawberry, but it's basically like yuppie. Yep. But yeah, I feel like I have a fascination with that because it's like middle upper class, like Mexico identity, yuppiedom. And like my mom's family is all obsessed with it. And like it's like wanting to be posh, right? But they're like country folk, right? But it, you know, it's like this idea of like sprinkling English when you speaking with like a potato in your mouth, con la papa, mi nombre es Paulina, you know, like stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Which is like the epitome of how you want to speak and be represented in terms of having money or whatever in Mexico. So like a difficulty I encountered assimilating into the U.S. was that I was living in a community where everyone spoke English back and forth. And then, you know, I would have like my mom be like, no, don't like mix them. You want to only speak one language. And I was having these standards of like, this is what we're not fresas, but we want to be. So this is what you should be acting like. This is also, it was an understanding of like, they're acting like what they think Europeans and Americans act like. And it's just empty well of shame about mm-hmm. being Mexican and being indigenous and like assimilating into Spanish culture. So for me, it was like a revelation to be like, oh, I can mix languages and it's fine. I'm not. And if I'm seen as lower class, who cares? Right. Like, because the American middle class was like more than we could obtain when we were in Mexico. So, I mean, just to be frank, too, it was just like I don't like have the experience you guys have, too. So, and I don't need to make these symbols and markers or whatever, which people still do when they come here, and then they hate the culture here because, you know, I mean, even though there's things that are similar, it feels like, well, why don't you understand? Like, and because I have an accent, you don't understand that I'm upper crust where I'm from, and I speak well when I'm there, but, you know, when I'm speaking to you, you don't understand who I really am or whatever. But I think like immigration is a truly humbling experience for most people. If you have a bunch of money, I'm sure, you know, whatever. But even in language, you'll be called out or whatever. So I think it tears that like sense of pride through money and like class out of people, which I think is really interesting and a really cool contemporary experience, especially in like materialism or whatever. But yeah, so I feel like Gloria and Salud is like, yeah, really onto it because, yeah, and then becoming this like new form of Chicano-ness or Mexican American-ness by like, you know, some people don't speak Spanish. And that was a big part of my project too. I used the symbol of like these rotting fruits because like a term, bocha or pocho, is like this term that you would use to someone who, their name is Gloria Anzaldúa or Mario Vasquez, and they don't speak Spanish. Yeah. Oh my God, you know, you're not really Chicano or whatever, you know. But I felt like, oh, this is a cool term. I thought it was like a funny joke. I was like, oh, it's like assimilation is like rotting, you know, and like rebirthing or something. I wanted to make a joke out of it because like, yeah, my Mexican family says that to me all the time. And instead of feeling like bad about it, I mean, you know, what can I do? This is where I live, and I only speak Spanish to you. Like, and I wish I would speak it more, but you know, most of my conversations are in English. So.
Yeah, I think it's helpful for people to know because this might be new territory for some of the folks who might listen to this. That there's like this perception around this whole situation that it's illegitimate. Right, this type of Spanish, it's like broken, right? And so I would, like, dare I compare it to, like, Black English, where it's illegitimate if you speak this way, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
So
there's a proper way to speak,
right? There's versus this idea that there's a proper way to speak, and so it's like it's a illegitimate form of Spanish.
Right, English. Yeah, and it's really interesting because, and I mean, I've read about like in England, like your class is tied into the way you speak, right? Like the more posh you are versus, and I hear like Well, from dating shows I've seen too, people with northern accents in England get it bad. It's like, it must be like having a country accent or something to them. So, yeah, to me, and I feel like coming even to the Midwest, even, the, you know, I'm all grown or whatever, but even then, like when I my first couple weeks of grad school, I was trying my hardest not to sound like, I'm a girl down from Austin, Texas, and I'm happy to be, go down to Bucky's and I-35, get myself a kolache, you know, whatever. So, but, you know, and then, because, you know, there's this, again, like this idea of like how you're supposed to be or whatever, especially for me, I think my mind's all muddled with family ideas of what I'm supposed to be and stuff. And like, it's been a battle to like really embrace myself and be like, you know what, maybe I don't want to be upper crust and I'm happy with who I am or whatever. And, you know, it's not that I'm not ambitious or whatever. It's that I'm, to me, it's been a whole journey to recognize who I really am in relationship to like where I've grown up, really grown up, not where my family's from or where they think, you know, whatever. And yeah, and then moving to places really helps you too. Like people know I'm Lebanese here. Some people will be like, hey, are you Lebanese? And I'll be like, oh my God, no one in my life has ever seen, recognized or had a suspicion about me, you know? Everyone's just been like, oh. Yeah.
Let's just ask a couple more to start wrapping it up.
Yeah.
Based on sort of some of the things that you've shared about your experiences and some of the vulnerabilities you've had with language, what is A, one of your favorite words or sentences, and B, what is a word or a phrase that is most representative of you?
Mm, okay. Mm-hmm. Let me just think about it for a sec.
It's difficult.
Okay, so for American, or just, I guess, words I like are, I love, like, cowboy glove, or like, just, like, like.
Where are your cowboy gloves at?
Yeah, they made me Texan, Western. I love, like, kind of these, like, frontera mm-hmm. words, like, tejano. I love, I mean, I think most about words when I'm listening to music and lyrics. So I feel like, yeah, that's kind of where my mind goes to. I love words I also mispronounce, like Ontario, Ontario. Yeah, something I live by and I think is representative of me. I like to think about having hope or like faith in things that everything's gonna be all right. That's like my motto, is like everything's gonna be fine, everything's gonna be cool, chill out. And yeah, okay, that's another funny story. My stepdad, who looked German but had a very thick Mexican accent, like his dad was like a Gulf Coast Guard who was stationed in Mexico, and he grew up his whole life in Mexico, and then he ended up in Brownsville and married my mom. But people would be like, what kind of accent do you have? Because he just, like, had the thickest, like, Mexican, because he learned English pretty late in life. But he would always be confused by me saying, like, oh, it's cool. He'd be like, is that a good thing? Because then I'd be like, that's hot. And he's like, is that bad? So, yeah, me saying, like, oh, everything's going to be chill, everything's going to be cool, I just kind of heard him be like, what does that mean? So everything's going to be fine, I think, is a very, yeah. And a dream is a seed is another life motto for me. And that, yeah, that came when I didn't really understand that fruits came from flowers. I watched all these videos on, like, fruit life and vegetable life cycles, and yeah, just seeing how a seed turns into a flower and then that turns into a fruit. And then, yeah, seeing how those fruit decays and then that's the, you know, the seed and the cycle starts again. That kind of, to me, opens up a lot of ideas in my life where I'm like, and it doesn't have to be like a dream or an aspiration. Just like even like how dreams are, where it's like a random amount of things happening and it's like, okay, this is a seed to something else, right? Yeah. Right. So yeah, those are kind of, and also another border story is whenever I have so many memories of us going to go buy fruits in Mexico And then when you get to the border, you have to take all the seeds out. Like, you have to take the seeds out of avocados, and you have to take the seeds out of things, which I think is like, so it speaks so much more than just that, like as part of like an immigration process and stuff. But I just think like seeds are really powerful. So, you know, I try to remember how like even these little things can blossom into, you know, something bigger and that I can eat, whatever.
Yeah, I remember when I first heard about that, like not being like, you have to take the seeds out, and I was like, oh, they don't want you to grow crops, man.
Yeah,
they don't want you to grow
well
stuff.
There's seed patents, right, like now and stuff. Seed banks are also really interesting things to like go check out. In Iowa, I've been into a couple of seed banks, so where you go see seeds.
Fancy.
But yeah,
okay. And so which of those phrases or words do you think best, like, represent you? Or represent you really well, anyway?
Like, a dream is a seed, or everything will be all right.
Everything? I don't know. You tell me. Which one do you feel like is, like, that's me. That's me.
One day at a time, I think, represents me. That's more of my, I think I'm trying to be like philosophical, but one day at a time, that's really got me through a lot. That
awesome.
Phrase, I'm like, one day. Yeah.
What do you wish that, like, beyond your accent, the language you speak, if you could, like, strip away all the things about you that might cause people to judge you negatively, what would you want them to, like, see?
That I'm just a girl in the community. I'm just a normal person.
Yes.
I just want to help.
Bringing it back to the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you... took us back there.
Yeah. Wow. Which is really, you know, with someone that has like mood disorders and wants you to know, like, I'm just normal, you know, I'm just a normal person in the community.
I'm here to help, guys.
Here to help. Yeah. Also, I feel like I can be very attached, or like I want to help and I want to assist, but I don't know, sometimes I feel like maybe it comes off as like wanting to do too much or whatever, but I just want to help. I'm just here to, I'm excited about a project or whatever. I just want to help and be part of a group. I think I have siblings, but I grew up an only child. So I think I have like a group syndrome where I'm like, yeah, I'm one of you guys, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah.
I don't mind it. So to take us out of here, contemplating the name of the show, We Are What We Speak. Do you agree or disagree that we are what we speak? Why or why not?
Yes. I mean, there's certain things I don't agree with. Like, I feel like people who put a lot of, like, quotes by, like, about peace or whatever, or like the least peaceful people I've ever met. But I mean, there's definitely a lot of affirmations that words can bring us. So I do feel like we are what we speak. At least we want to be what we speak, right? I would love, I feel like I'm a Valley girl. I try to sound like I'm the Valley, you know, or whatever. nombre, sir. But yeah, I feel like there's some truth to it. I feel like we want to be what we speak. But at least in my perspective, I'm very cautious with my word. I try to be as thoughtful, and I try to stick to my word. I you know, I don't like to break my word. So that's kind of my perspective on it. I want to be what I speak, and I am. But sometimes, you know, I retweet those peace quotes in my angriest moments, right? So I don't know. Remind myself, right?
Perfect. That was awesome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Produced in partnership with Ann Arbor District Library and recorded at Fifth Avenue Studios.